let me explain a little bit more on the known E. coli that you have this week. The known E. coli. It's supposed to be a non-lactoferrin. But it didn't turn out to be that way, did it?
It's supposed to be what? A
non-lactosamine E. coli, just so you could see it, which is still number four, but I wanted you to see it. But apparently we got a lactosamine from the stock room, so you do not have to do all the flow chart workup on that one. You may have, some of you may have already done it, that's great. But you don't have to do that. Since we've done E. coli a few times. You may do it again, you can do it if you want to, but you don't have to. Just at least a TSI. Well, we already did that, so.
But do we have to report it?
Just TSI. What it looks like on your, because you did streak it to the media, so just describe what you've done so far. That's all you have to do now. Okay, so here we go. GI week two disease. Oh. I used to use scriptures quite a bit. I haven't done that. I've gotten away from that. Fixate on cats. Here's a scripture for you. Deuteronomy 9:7. You think that applies? Especially after this last exam. Okay, remember and forget not. So I may beat you over the head with Deuteronomy 9:7. Okay, here we go with Vibrionaceae. This is just a little review. In the family Vibrionaceae are three genera, Vibrio, Pneumonas, Plesiomonas. Remember and forget not. Okay, Vibrio is found mostly in salt water, predominantly. Pneumonas is can be found in both, but predominantly fresh water. We said that's what is found, can be found in sink traps, drain pipes, things like that. And Plesiomonas is only in fresh water. Just to set those off. Okay, they are gram-negative rods, facultative. Oxidase positive. Why are they oxidase positive? Now, why is that important, I should say?
Because it
differentiates them from the Enterobacteriaceae, which are all oxidase negative. Okay, well, it's important to screen colonies for oxidase. And if they are mobile, it's color flagella, particularly Vibrio. What's the flagella pattern in Enterobacteriaceae?
The P word.
Paratrichus. P word. Polar is a P word. That doesn't work. Okay, let's go to the main disease state from Vibrio cholera, which is Asiatic cholera, or the classic cholera that we see. Not so much in this country, unless people have been traveling to endemic areas and brought it back, but it is a big third world problem. Okay, this organism, well, in general, the Vibrios, not just Vibrio cholera, but the Vibrios are enhanced, growth is enhanced with an alkaline pH. So they prefer an alkaline pH. They will not grow in an acid pH as well with most organisms. The special media, what does TCBS stand for?
Citrate.
What's the C? Citrate. Biosulfate, citrate, biosulfate, sucrose, longer. Okay. We also do serotyping on this one. So we test for the O1 antigen, which is the somatic antigen. And we can then subdivide that into biotypes or serotypes by further serotyping or biochemical reactions into the cholera subtype, which is the classic organism that causes the disease. There's also another subtype called L4 that causes the disease. So we can do serotyping on this and further biochemical testing to divide it even further. Okay, does its major pathogenic factor or virulence mechanism is an enterotoxin, which we call cholerogen. And we'll see what the action of cholerogen is here. Okay. All right, and just in general, you don't need to know specifics of this, but in general, because there are other toxins that follow this same model. This is a classic model of toxin action. You may have learned this somewhere else. But the cholerogen, or the enterotoxin produced by Vibrio cholera, has five subunits. Four of these are called I have 6 subunits, actually. Fuck. 7. 7 subunits, yeah. I'm looking just at the Bs. The 5 units of B, and then 2 A subunits. So B is the binding part or subunit of the toxin. And it binds to a certain receptor that's found on our intestine cells. And that facilitates entry of the A subunit, which is the one that has the biological activity. By breaking certain bonds and things, A can get in there. So what A does, just in general, is it binds, well, we have a G regulatory system in here, G protein. And what the G protein regulatory system does is to regulate the action of this enzyme, adenylate cyclase or adenyl cyclase, from inactive to active. If this enzyme is active, what it does is catalyze the conversion of ATP into cyclic AMP. So we've got the energy source inside the cell. That breaks down to produce cyclic AMP. And in normal situations, what that does is just acts on the cell membrane to stimulate a little outpouring of some of the water in the electrolytes. But in the case of, in the presence of collagen, this A subunit transfers an ADP ribose unit from this NAD that's attached to the regulatory protein over here, causing this G stimulatory protein to be in the active state continually, constantly activated. And what that means is that if this enzyme is constantly activated because it's got the ADP ribose unit on it, then it is constantly catalyzing this reaction to produce adenylate cyclase, excessive amounts of adenylate cyclase, which in turn causes excessive production of cyclic AMP from ATP. So the main problem here is we get this excessive amount of cyclic AMP inside the cell. That then acts as a second messenger to stimulate the transport mechanism in the cell membrane. That's where we get the rapid outpouring of water and electrolytes, sodium, potassium, bicarbonate. So if this is constantly stimulated, then we've got this constant outpouring of electrolytes and water. And that's the main problem in the disease. So just, again, not specifics, but just in general, what the action of the toxin does. We talked about the LT toxin of E. coli, the heat lab myotoxin, acts in the same way. It's just not quite as severe as is cholera. So there are other toxins that follow the same mechanism.
That's a protein. So A1 is ADP ribose?
A1 transfers, it catalyzes the transfer of, the ADP ribose is found on NAD. So it transfers an ADP ribose from NAD over to this G protein. So now it is ADP ribosylated, which maintains it in its active state. So it's constantly catalyzing this reaction.
Does the cell die or does it just shrink up?
The cell usually probably dies. Some of them, they don't always have to die from this action, because it's not actually acting on killing the cell, but it depends on how long this process is stimulated. Because eventually, if the inside of the cell becomes dehydrated due to loss of water and electrolytes, then the cell's going to die. Okay, so symptoms of cholera then. Main symptoms, diarrhea and vomiting, which leads to dehydration, as we've seen from that mechanism. So what the patient usually dies of, if they die, or what they're really sick of, even if they recover, is mostly the dehydration and electrolyte loss. And the electrolyte loss results in a metabolic acidosis, which upsets the pH balance of the body. So those are the two things that the patient dies of, the dehydration and electrolyte loss. They can lose up to 15 to 20 liters of water per day. That's an excessive amount, obviously. The stool sample, the diarrhea, is called a rice water stool. And apparently it has no odor. There's no real pain associated with it, because it's not a dysentery, it's a diarrhea. But it's called a rice water stool because there are little mucus flecks in there that look like little grains of rice. Mucus flecks have lots of bacteria in there. And you can have upwards of 1 million vibrio per milliliter of water stool. Yeah. It's that extensive in severe cases. So you can see how contagious it would be. You can contaminate easily the water supply. And that's usually what the cause is contamination of the sewage into the water supply, the drinking water, and they become contaminated. And when you get outbreaks of this, which we do periodically in the third world countries, and it's always a possibility in places like Haiti, where they have this such devastation and disrupts their whole system, sewage system, water system, whatever, you can get outbreaks of cholera. Okay, so the mucus flex then, containing the vibrios, contribute to this rice water stool. Now, patients oftentimes will lay on these cholera cots. You may have seen pictures of cholera cots before. They have a little hole in the center with a sleeve that drains down to a bucket, and that collects the stool sample, because oftentimes they're so weak, and it's just a continual runny mess that they can't get up and run to the outhouse. There's another picture here, too, of actual patients. You can see the hole in the center here. It looks like, well, that other one looked like a steel slab. This looks like a pool table with a hole in the center instead of pockets. Anyway, in severe cases, they can have IV solutions. And that's what these patients have, to replace the fluid and the electrolytes. But usually the therapy is oral replacement therapy with fluids and electrolytes. We talked about those little, did we talk about those packets?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That contain powdery electrolytes, bicarbonate, potassium chloride, glucose solution in there, and all they have to do is rehydrate that in a liter of water and consume it. So if they can consume enough water and electrolytes to replace what they're losing, then they're probably not going to die from it. But if they can't, they can die within a matter of hours to just a few days. You can't tolerate that extreme loss of fluids and electrolytes. Now, the other treatment is that they can administer antibiotics, tetracycline and others, which will lessen the amount of organism in there, which in turn lessens the severity of the disease. But again, it's a catch-22, because if they're living in these countries, they don't have access to antibiotics as much, so they probably don't get the antibiotic treatment. Treated, the mortality rate is only 1%. Untreated, it can be upwards of 60% because of that massive loss of the fluid and the electrolytes. Okay, let's see. Did I cover everything over? Yeah, I did. Yes?
I was just wondering, if you treat it, how long does it last?
3 days, 3-4 days. Probably you just have to get the organism killed it out of the system and then restore that balance between the G proteins so that you're not stimulating that adenyl cyclase enzyme.
If there's an outbreak, what do you do to stop the outbreak?
The main thing is not drinking contaminated water, if possible, the water and make sure all the food is clean and washed. That's about all you can do. If you catch it, you've got to have therapy. Hopefully that therapy is available. But if not, and not everybody that is untreated dies. I mean, obviously, there's at least 40% here that don't die from it, even if they're not treated. So the other thing would just be to consume as much water as you can to keep up with the water loss. Of course, you'd like to replace that with electrolytes as well, but that may not be available. Okay, so that's cholera. You can be grateful. There are many things to be grateful for. But we don't have cholera in this part of the country. You don't have to experience that. You might get flu, colds, whatever. But. Okay, Vibrio parahemolyticus. This is what we encounter most frequently in the lab. Causes of gastroenteritis, and it comes primarily from incompletely cooked seafood. What's the difference between sushi and sashimi?
Sashimi is the raw fish only.
Raw fish only?
Usually with raw fish and rice.
And what's sushi?
That's sushi.
Yeah. What's
sashimi is raw fish only.
Sushi has the rice with it. Okay. I don't eat either. But Yuki does. She has. Yesterday she had rice and seaweed.
Sushi's good.
But that's not raw fish.
Well, she has fish eggs the day before that.
It's pretty cool.
Pretty cool, huh? Okay. Yeah. And you can get cholera that way too by eating incompletely cooked shellfish or raw shellfish, primarily shellfish. Okay, what is the word halophilic?
Likes salt.
Salt, right. Because Vibrios are found primarily in seawater. They could be found in freshwater. But remember that salt tolerance test we looked at where we do tubes with varying degrees of salt concentration, sodium chloride salt concentration? Vibrio cholera doesn't require salt, but obviously can grow in salt. But Vibrio parahemolyticus does require a salt, at least a 2% sodium chloride solution to grow. Okay, and then the third species of Vibrio that we talked about was Vulnificus. Remember, there are more, but we're just talking about these three. And Vulnificus primarily causes wound infections and septicemia. Patients usually have had contact with seawater or contact with handling shellfish, which is the way they can get the organism into a wound or an abrasion and cause a deeper infection or get into the blood and cause a severe septicemia. On occasion, it can cause a diarrhea, but it's mostly associated with the wound and the septicemia symptoms. Okay, let's talk about a new one, Clostridium difficile. Clostridium, the whole genus, is a spore-forming anaerobe. This is an anaerobe. And we'll talk more about Clostridium when we do the anaerobe section, which is the very last section. But this one has to do with GI symptoms, so we have to mention it here. This is a very important one. Cases are increasing. But what this does is it causes, or is responsible for, two types of diseases. One is called antibiotic-associated diarrhea, AAD. Clostridium difficile is one cause. It is not the only cause. There are other organisms that can cause antibiotic-associated diarrhea. But the more serious manifestation is pseudomembranous colitis. And Clostridium difficile is the only cause of pseudomembranous colitis. Okay, so what happens is first of all, antibiotic-associated diarrhea is mostly just a watery diarrhea. Not as severe, but if a patient has been on antibiotic therapy for something else that can wipe out some of the normal flora in the gastrointestinal tract, allow this organism to proliferate and cause a watery diarrhea. And it's usually self-limiting. Pseudomembranous colitis, however, is much more severe, but it is also associated with antibiotic therapy. Most antibiotics, but especially broad-spectrum antibiotics, potent ones, will wipe out more of the normal flora, and then that causes this, or allows this organism to generate from its spores and produce its toxins. So it results in a bloody diarrhea. So the lining of the large intestine, which is colitis, kind of flushes off, and it becomes necrotic, necrosis of colon mucosa, and that's why it's so severe. And it usually results from a patient, usually they're hospitalized patients that have had antibiotic therapy within 8 weeks. Okay, so this is a very serious disease. What's the laboratory's role in identifying this disease? Well, we can culture it. Here's a new media for you to put on your list, CCFA. Stands for cycloserine cefoxitin fructose auger. CCFA. Okay, the problem with this is it takes 48 to 72 hours incubation on this media before we can identify it. And we can get false positives, meaning that the organism can grow, but again, like other organisms that we've talked about, primarily the Cyanobacterium diphtheriae, it has to be the organism that produces the toxin. So some people can harbor Clostridium difficile in the intestinal tract that is the non-toxigenic strain. But we're not going to be able to differentiate those just from growth. So we can get false positives. So what we have to do, if we grow it and identify it as Clostridium difficile, then we have to determine if it is the toxigenic producing organism. The gold standard, the test that has been done most often is for toxin detection, is a cell cytotoxic assay. And routine laboratories will not be able to do this test, so they have to send it to a laboratory that does cell cytotoxicity tests. It takes 18 to 48 hours. It's still not real quick. There are two toxins that are produced by Clostridium difficile. Ideally, we'd like to identify both of them, toxin A and toxin B, but especially, and I've started this, especially toxin B, since that seems to be the one that's responsible for the necrosis of the lining of the intestine.
So does that toxin detection, so do you have to, can you get it from the original stool sample, or do you have to wait for it to grow out on the CCFA?
You grow it on the colony, or you grow the colony from the stool sample, and then you identify it.
So you have to wait the 48 to 72 hours right. first, and then another 18 to 48 hours to identify it.
Yes, and so in order to get around that time period, there's a newer test, which is an enzyme immunoassay. It only takes 4 hours. It has approximately 80 to 90% sensitivity. There are some tests that are a little bit less sensitive than that, but that means there's going to be how many false negatives?
20%.
Up to 20%, 10 to 20% false negatives. So, just like we said with a rapid strep test, if it's negative on the throat swab, the rapid strep test, then it should be sent to the lab for confirmation, for growth and confirmation. Same thing applies here. Confirm the negatives with a cell cytotoxic acid. Okay, now I have a paper here, and this is the newest thing that is out. And I'm not going to spend time discussing it so much. This PCR test for C. difficile. So I just want you to read this. It's just one page. I think we can find time to read this. And it's pretty interesting. It talks about how much money is spent per year on treating patients that end up with C. difficile from as an adenosine infection. So we can minimize that to some extent by being able to identify it sooner, which is what this method does. So just kind of read through that when you get time. And it shows you again the trend that is coming, and is in fact in some cases is already there for the microbiology lab. And again, you will be the people that do these kind of tests. Okay, Campylobacter jejuni, most frequent cause of bacterial gastroenteritis in the U.S. It hasn't always been appreciated as a pathogen. It's only been about 30, 40 years or so that they've identified Campylobacter. And its significance in stool samples. Okay. ID stands for infectious dose. Some people can be infected and get the disease with as little as 500 organisms. Some people require up to 10 to the 6th organisms to manifest the disease. And in fact, some people with that many organisms don't get the disease. So it's very individual as to who's going to get it and who isn't. Invades the mucosal membrane, and it results in bloody diarrhea. So you're going to find white cells, red cells. Well, maybe we should quit early today. Because I better not be getting sick. I'll blame somebody if I am. And it also produces some toxins. Okay, symptoms of Campylobacter infection, gastroenteritis. Fever, headache, myalgia, you get these more systemic symptoms because it does invade abdominal pain, cramping. What's the word for cramping? Tenesmus. In less severe cases, it can be just a watery diarrhea, but it's often the bloody diarrhea. And we get it from contaminated milk, water, meat, cattle. Poultry, we talked about that the other day, as I mentioned. And it can be found in domestic animals, like dogs and cats. There's our cat trotting across the field.
I thought in parasitology we learned that tenesmus is like the urge to go.
It's an urge that comes from, well, along with that you get pain and cramping. You're just mesmerized by the cat, aren't you?
Yeah.
But like I said, I've never gotten Campylobacter from my cats. Oh, by the way, I am fostering a new cat. So I now have 5 cats, but this one's just a foster cat. Have you ever heard of foster cats?
Yeah.
Anybody can do it. But this cat, I just got it last Friday, this cat is pregnant.
Oh,
it was a homeless. We get them from the homeless shelter, they call and ask. We were on their list for fostering. We just fostered two little kittens that were so fun. But this was pregnant, and they couldn't accept it at the shelter unless they had a foster home to keep it until the babies. And then we have to keep the babies 6 to 8 weeks. Then we take them back to the shelter and get their vaccines, get new or whatever. And then they put them up for adoption, so we do guarantee that they'll get adopted. So it's a nice way to handle these stray cats. So we've got this, and I've never gone through cat birth.
That surprises me.
Piece of cake.
Is she ready? Yeah, we've got bad kids every 6 weeks.
So I'm not going to have any pain or clamping?
No.
Well, I'll let you know what happens. she's still young. She's not even a year old. And so hopefully the litter will be a little smaller first time. So we'll see. It's kind of interesting because my four other cats are not sure what's going on. I'm sure they can detect something's happening. She keeps wandering around looking for tiny places. Yeah, so it's soon, but I don't know how soon. Okay, so this one can be treated with antibiotics. Erythromycin is one choice, but there are others, obviously, that can be used in severe cases. But usually, again, it's self-limiting. 90%+ of cases are self-limiting and don't need treatment, but severe cases probably do. This one is more predominant, I would guess, in children that are in daycare centers, nurseries, those kinds of things that are easily passed around. So it can be passed person to person, too, as well, from fecal oral contamination, as well as the water, meat, things. Okay, now, this slide is from our very first week. A couple weeks ago, we started talking about GI diseases. I just put this in here just to review that diarrhea is defined as 3 or more unformed stools per day, and that we can classify it into the non-infective and the infective. Okay, remember talking about this? Remember forgetting that? Okay, we've been talking about the infective up to this part, those that are produce disease by toxins and those that are invasive. So infective means that we actually have to consume the organism. And then the organism produces this toxin or invades and does whatever we've been talking about. Now, we're going to switch gears here and talk about the non-infective, which means we don't ingest the organism, but we ingest a preformed toxin. So this is commonly known as food poisoning. Have you all had food poisoning? Anybody here never had food poisoning? Really?
Oh,
you have not. Oh, you have had it from Subway, huh? Oh, possible, yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about just some of them. And this isn't all of the cases of food poisoning, but some of the probably more common ones. You've certainly heard of Staph aureus as a causative agent of food poisoning. Usually from meat, dairy products, potato salad, cream puffs, ham. Those things that are high in sugar and high in salt, because that creates a high osmotic pressure, and staph can withstand the high osmotic pressure, whereas many other organisms can't. Usually we get symptoms within 2 to 6 hours. Do you remember the symptoms of salmonella, salmonellosis, or when they occur?
18 to 48 hours.
So usually, on the average, 18 hours. So why does it take longer for salmonella to develop symptoms and shorter for Staph aureus?
It's just the toxin.
Right, because you've already got the toxin. The toxin's already formed. You ingest the toxin and it just goes to work immediately. Toxin, if it's in the food that you consume, doesn't have any taste, so you don't know you ingest it. No taste, no odor, nothing. It doesn't change anything. Usually what happens in Staph aureus food intoxication is the food has been prepared by somebody who probably either has staph on their hands, and they wash their hands carefully, or they're carriers of staph in nasal passages. We talked about how many people, upwards of 30% of people, can harbor staph aureus in the nasal passages. They get it on their hands, so they don't use good technique in hand washing. The organism gets into the food, and then the organism proliferates and produces the toxin, and especially if the toxin is left, or if the food is left at room temperature. So when you go to church picnics, family reunions, that kind of thing. You oftentimes, or not often, but occasionally can get food poisoning from those things. Again, the high sugar, high salt. But potato salad is a good culprit as well. So you just want to make sure you, those that are preparing the food, wash their hands and use good technique. And refrigerate. If it's refrigerated, then it's not going to be able to produce the toxins.
So I was reading this thing about safe ways to defrost meat. And it said that, you know, you can put it in the fridge or you can put it in cold water. But they said that even defrosting in the microwave isn't really a good idea. I don't get why, though, because if you're cooking it, like, right after you defrost it, there's really no time for it to...
Well, cooking can kill the organism, but it doesn't necessarily kill the toxin. Because there are some toxins that are heat stable, and cooking won't necessarily kill it. So reheating the food is not going to kill the toxin.
So it's freezing to do the toxin.
Freezing, probably, if it's frozen immediately, will prevent the organism from producing the toxin in the first place.
So while it's defrosting, there's enough time for it to produce the toxin, or is the toxin already there?
Either way, it could be both. Depends on how long it was left out before it was frozen, as to whether the toxin was produced or not. So the best way is, like you said, defrost it in the refrigerator or in cold water to keep it cold. I have defrosted many chickens, just leaving them on the countertop, which I know is not a good idea, but I've never gotten sick from that. So I guess I've just been lucky. I haven't gotten sick from my cats, from my raw eggs, from my uncooked chicken. Okay, so that's the Staph aureus story. But you can get it from hamburgers, fast food joints, McDonald's, in the salsa. It can be in the salsa in Mexican places. Bacillus cereus, you may not have heard of this one, but it is relatively common as a food intoxication, particularly found in cooked meat, poultry, vegetables. It takes a little bit longer for the symptoms to appear. Clostridium perfringens, type A, there are different types. This has to be type A. Pretty much the same symptoms as Bacillus cereus. I think Bacillus cereus is also associated with Chinese food. Chinese food that has, when you get the pig out. And so you've maybe left it out on the counter for a little while, or refrigerated it maybe and then left it out or something. Not one bit. This is mentioned. Okay, then I put Clostridium botulinum down here just to show you that it also produces a food poisoning, but it is much more severe, obviously, in terms of botulism. This organism primarily occurs in home canned foods that have not been processed properly, because this organism, like Clostridium difficile, is a spore-forming anaerobe. So you have to process it with steam under pressure, like a pressure cooker or an autoclave, to kill the spores. Otherwise, the spores can stay in there and generate the toxin. This is a neurotoxin. We ingest the food. It doesn't take very much. This is one of the most potent toxins around. It can cause a flaccid paralysis, which is just a weakness, an inability to contract the muscles. And that primarily affects the respiratory system. The patient can't breathe. Their lungs can't inflate and deflate. And they have to be on oxygen. Many people can die from it, but some people do survive. It is also a causative agent in infant botulism, one of the causes of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. And in this case, it's a little bit different because the infant actually ingests the organism, not just the spore, but the organism. And the organism colonizes the intestinal tract, and because the infant doesn't yet have a full complement of normal flora in there, which we do, that's why if we ingest the organism, we're not going to get the disease, because we've got enough normal flora in there to fight it off and not allow it to stabilize and colonize. But the infant doesn't, so the organism can colonize the intestinal tract and then produce the neurotoxin. And we know that in sudden infant death syndrome, the infant can go to bed fine at night and in the morning, they're not alive anymore. So it's not common, but one thing to avoid is, well, two things to avoid. Honey, because the honey apparently has spores on it, or some of it, if it's not processed properly. Now, how does the spores get in the honey? From the bees. Supposedly the bees, as the bees pollinate plants and stuff, they can pick up the spores and transfer it to the hive where it's processed into the honey. So, and I was wondering how babies get honey, but apparently they dip their little
globule, dip a pathogen in there to get the egg somehow.
So don't do that. The other thing is vacuum dust. It spreads spores around.
Vacuum dust?
Vacuum dust. But that's easy. Just don't make the kid vacuum.
What if you're vacuuming around the kid? Don't vacuum.
Yeah, it's a waste of time because 6 months later you can do it all over again. Okay. Okay, no naps. Don't be like this class. This was actually one of our classes a year ago. And because I keep telling them, no naps. This is what they did at the end of the class, the end of the semester, and took a picture and gave me the picture. But that's pretty typical. That's what they all look like. So now you know what you guys look like.
Yeah, but that's not your physics class.
That was the clinical chemistry class in the other room. Okay, let's do a review. I've got some organisms up here, and I've got some results down here. So you tell me as we go through. Let's start with Yersinia. Tell me if it is lactose positive or negative. Usually, lactose negative.
Lactose
negative. Yeah. Is it oxidase positive or negative?
Positive.
What?
Negative.
Now, where does Yersinia belong? What family of organisms? It's still Enterobacteriaceae, so it has to be oxidase negative, right? Okay. Remember, forget not. PSI. Does it require any special media?
Yes.
What does that stand for?
Short for yourself.
All right. We'll know that by next week. What do we do with CIN auger? 145, 137. Okay. We can also do a cold enrichment. I'm not sure whether I mentioned that or not. Occasionally that might enhance the growth of Yersinia. But labs don't usually do that because it takes a week or longer to enhance the growth. Morphology. Does it have any distinguishing features on gram stain?
Bipolar staining.
Okay, so here is our Yersinia. That's usually lactose negative, oxidative negative. CIN, enhancement might help in the bipolar state. So those are the main characteristics of Yersinia. Okay, let's go into Vibrio. Lactose positive or negative? Well, what about oxidase?
Positive.
Okay, the rest of them are not Enterobacteriaceae. So oxidase positive. What about TSI? Depends really on the species, because there can be some species that are lactose positive or that utilize sucrose. So if it utilizes sucrose, then what will the TSI be? Great. Okay, any special media for Vibrio?
TCBS.
Anything else we do? Is there an enrichment technique? What kind of broth?
Selenite.
Not selenite.
GN.
So what does APW stand for? Alkaline peptone water. Yeah. Okay. We can do the sodium chloride tolerance test as well. And what's the gram stain? Special characteristic that we may see. Morphology. Not gram stain, but the morphology. Curved, common shaped. Okay, so usually lactose negative, oxidase positive, it can be K over A or A over A, depending upon if it's a sucrose fermenter or not. TCBS, alkaline peptone water, sodium chloride, some require sodium chloride, and the curved organisms. Aeromonas, lactose positive negative. What was the Aeromonas that you did yesterday? One unknown. Lactose negative. Okay, oxidase? Positive. TSI? Depends on if it utilizes sucrose or not. Okay, any special media? Do you just grow on routine media? Do you use anything special for Aeromonas? What does it look like on sheep blood auger? Beta hemolytic. And anything unusual about the morphology? Think gram stain morphology. Okay, so it's usually lactose negative. Occasionally, we can see a lactose positive one. Oxidase positive, K over A, A over A, if it is lactose positive or if it utilizes sucrose. Beta hemolytic on blood, and it's just a gram-negative rod, nothing distinguishable about morphology. What about Pleisomonas, lactose? Mostly lactose negative. Oxidase?
Positive.
TSI? K over A. Any special media for Pleisomonas? Grows on just the routine media. And anything unusual about the Gram-Stain morphology? Okay, so it's lactose negative, oxidase positive, K over A. Nothing, no media that we need. It'll grow on blood and MAC. And it's just a gram-negative rod, nothing unusual. Can be. Lactose, positive, negative. Positive. You're not sure?
Negative.
Negative? Okay. What about oxidase?
Positive.
Positive. TSI? K over K. Or K over no change. It's asaccharolytic. It doesn't utilize the sugars. Any special media?
Campy.
What do we do with campy SBA?
Micro-air.
Jar.
42
degrees. Candle jar. How long?
48
hours. Okay, today's your lucky day. We get to unveil the campy jar today. Okay, what do the colonies look like? We did use the, some terms to describe
the colonies.
Colonies. Runny, moist, mucoidy. Okay, so we'll look at those today. And the morphology, tiny, curved. What's a special word that we use in here? As long as
going.
Okay, two of them together. So it is lactose negative, oxidase positive, does not utilize the sugar, so it's K over no change. You've got the campy SBA and the tiny, curved rods. What about Pseudomonas? Now, why did I put Pseudomonas in here? What's its morphology? What's its Gram-Stain reaction? Remember Pseudomonas? Gram-negative rod. It's a Gram-negative rod, right?
Yes.
So, can we find it in a stool sample?
Yes.
How many people approximately can have Pseudomonas in a stool sample?
A lot.
Well, at least up to 10%. May not be a lot, but at least up to 10% of people carry Pseudomonas in the stool sample as normal flora. It's not pathogenic. So that's why we need to be aware of it, because it can be confused. What's the lactose reaction of Pseudomonas?
Negative.
Oxidase? Okay. Okay, it's lactose negative, it's oxidase positive, which is why we include it in here, because it's going to look like a gram-negative rod, an Enterobacteriaceae, in a stool sample. So again, another good reason to screen. Oxidase positive, we put it to TSI, and it's K over no change. Why is it K over no change? What group of organisms did we study last week?
Non-fermenter.
It's a non-fermenter, okay? Remember and forget not. It's a non-fermenter, so it doesn't utilize the sugar, so we get K over no change, just like campy. We did Müller-Nitten, 42 degrees. Remember doing that? It does grow on regular media, but that was a special one that we looked for to see if it grows at 42, which it does, and to see if it produces a pigment. Hyoscyanin, which was what color?
Green.
Why did you miss that on the exam? Gram-negative rod. Okay, really quick. We've got a brief case study to review a couple more things here. Okay, this is a 25-year-old, previously healthy woman, made of the ER for evaluation of bloody diarrhea and diffuse abdominal pain of 24 hours duration. She complained of nausea and vomiting. She denied a history of inflammatory bowel disease, previous diarrhea, or contact with other individuals with diarrhea. Onset of symptoms began 24 hours after eating an undercooked hamburger at a local fast food restaurant. The rectal exam revealed watery stool with gross blood present. Sigmoidoscopy showed diffuse mucosal erythema. What's erythema? Redness. And petechiae. Death pinpoint hemorrhage with modest exudation but no ulceration or pseudomembranes. So what might we rule out here? No pseudomembranes. that one. Okay, what are possible pathogens based on that history? Shigella. Possibly. What else?
Clostridium.
Not Clostridium difficile. There were no pseudomembranes. She wasn't a hospitalized patient. This is her only 24 hours after eating.
Salmonella.
Anything else? Shigella, Campi, E. coli, Salmonella, Ursinia, Aeromonas, Plesiomonas. Don't forget those. Okay, those are all possibilities just based on things. Okay, what kind of sample do we want? How do we want to process it? Through stool. Process within 1 to 2 hours. We have transported, carry blood transport. Media. If we want to set up the whole battery, we would do this, right? Now, what if we were living in a Midwestern state, not around the coast? What would we exclude? Probably TCBS. We're looking for Vibrio there. We're not likely to see Vibrio. Or in beautiful downtown Provo. Okay. So we're not going to set up this whole battery every time. It just depends on what we're looking for, what location you're at. Okay, what do you want to do next? You want to do gram stain on the sample? Stool sample? Correct gram stain? What are you looking for? On the stool sample, you're looking for fecal leukocytes, perhaps red blood cells as an indication of invasion, absence of gram-negative organisms, excessive gram-positives. What about morphology of organisms? Gram-negative rods.
Commas.
Comma shape, like your embryo. So that's what we're looking for when we do gram stain. We're not going to see pathogen if it's not one of those. Okay, these are the media reactions. Pink on MAC, what does that tell you? Yellow on HE, what does that tell you? Fermenter or non-fermenter? Yellow is a fermenter, but it doesn't have lactose in it. There's other sugars in there. CIN, pink, but no bullseye. Will other things grow on CIN besides Ursinia? Say yes.
Yes.
Okay. No growth on Campi, no growth on TCBS. Okay, now, what next? Gram stain from the colonies. Okay, it turned out to be gram-negative rod, short. Negative oxidase. PSI. Way over A with gas. Now what are we going to do?
Invic.
Okay. So pathogen is E. coli of what? Strain
C.
What are we going to do to identify that? Other serotypes. Okay. All right, you guys. Study this stuff.